Welcome to another episode of COVID Chronicles, a podcast by, for, and about people affiliated with Portland Mennonite Church in Portland, Oregon. I'm your host, Gloria Nussbaum, and my guest is Esther Nelson. Welcome, Esther. I'm so happy to have you join me.
Glad to be with you.
You are someone that I don't really know very much about, so I'm really looking forward to hearing some of your story. And as usual, where were you born?
I was born in Fairport Harbor, Ohio, a small town on Lake Erie, where there's a fairly substantial, or there was at the time, a fairly large Finnish immigrant population. But even then, when I was born, my parents were already packing. We were on the move to New York City, so I don't have any childhood there.
And what was taking your family to New York City?
My dad was a pastor of a bilingual church, a Lutheran church in Fairport Harbor. He had been there particularly during the war because he was able to help the local military folks with communicating with immigrant families who had boys in the war. So after the war, he continued his education at Columbia, and we already knew that we would be going to New York when he was able.
And when you talk about the war, we're talking World War II.
World War II, right.
Was this bilingual church English, Finnish?
It was, right. I might also add that I didn't speak English till I went to school. Of course, I spoke some English, but very intentionally, my parents spoke Finnish at home. And so until I went to school, I really was immersed in the Finnish community.
So did you pretty much grow up in New York? Was that, again, just kind of temporary till your father got through school?
My dad intended to finish up his coursework there, but after 3 years, he was recruited by a small Finnish Lutheran college in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. And it was a time when all of the Nordic Lutherans were talking about their identity. Were they going to retain their ethnic identity, or were they going to become the church in America? And so there were decisions to be made about the schools and the congregations, and eventually resulted in a merger of all of the Nordic groups. But we were in the Upper Peninsula for 3 years and helped the school through those decisions, came back to New York, continued his program, and we lived there until I was in the seventh grade.
I grew up at the other end of New York State near Buffalo, but I don't really know anything about New York City in terms of even to ask you which part of the city you were growing up in. But tell us a little bit about which part of the city. And
I lived in Brooklyn. We lived in Brooklyn, immigrant neighborhood. Brooklyn has very distinct neighborhoods. We have names that really define the history and a geography. And Sunset Park neighborhood was and still is, interestingly, an immigrant neighborhood because it runs from the docks where a lot of people have been able to get work, manual labor. And then this community moved up a hill around a park, Sunset Park, a wonderful city park. I spent much of those years in the park, in the three swimming pools and tennis courts. And then the neighborhood, Sunset Park neighborhood, was further divided into little ethnic enclaves. And so we lived in an area called Finntown. But my school, my second school in Brooklyn, had 2,000 students between first and sixth grade. And in my classes, I had kids from almost any ethnicity, mostly European. And then over the years, the Finns moved out, the Norwegians moved out, and it's turned over. It's been Southeast Asian, it's been Puerto Rican, it's had many identities.
A little microcosm of the U.S.
It was a wonderful place to grow up. And I had, a world-class education, and the city had all kinds of wonderful things to offer for free. The United Nations was being established. It was a rich, diverse childhood. I
it probably didn't seem unusual to you at the time. Was it just sort of that that's where your family lived and that's how life was? Or did you think about that it was maybe different from some other places?
I think I just accepted it. I didn't know enough about the rest of the world. I had strong memories of the Upper Peninsula, however. That was a very stark comparison. And for a little while, when I first returned to Brooklyn, I went to a fancy private school as a scholarship student. And a limousine came into our immigrant neighborhood and picked me up. I was the second pickup on the route. And every other stop was at some fancy apartment generally where a nanny or a doorman walked the kids to the limousine. And then we came home the same way. So I was really aware of a different world, a whole different culture inside the city that, you know, I wasn't really a part of that world. But I want to tell a story here because of our racial justice Sunday school. I thought about it so often. In the limousine, the kids taunted me because of where I lived and what I wore and my lunch and a number of other things. And after several months, the limousine driver, who was a black fellow in a uniform, opened the sliding glass panel and told the kids to knock it off and to shape up. And I have thought so often about what courage it must have taken that man, who was a black employee of an all-white institution, for him to stand up for me. And I don't know, it's so humbling. I wish somehow anything about him or where life took him.
Did things improve after that?
They did.
The kids listened to what he had to say, the other children.
Right. I don't know that today that would have worked, but...
And what grade was that you...
First grade. My first year of school. And actually, by the end of the year, I was pretty well integrated, at least in the classroom. But I came home to a different world and then leaned on my parents heavily to let me go to the neighborhood school after that.
And they did?
They did.
Why did you feel it was important, or why did you want to make that change?
Well, I came home and all my friends, I wanted friends that were more than school friends. And then I was disadvantaged in the neighborhood because all the neighborhood kids went to school together. So I loved the summer when I got to know the kids, and I didn't want to leave them. So,
talk a bit about what you remember about the Upper Peninsula. What ages would you have been during those 3 years?
3 to 6.
But you have some pretty strong memories?
I do. In 1950, we had 22 feet of snow. Of course, it wasn't 22 feet high all of the time, but there was a certain point when the city asked our parents if they wanted to have the cars out of their garages to move them out because the plows would be piling banks so high that access to driveways and garages would be impossible. And then I remember walking to school, and the first thing we had was a check for frostbite at the door. And the teachers, if we had signs of frostbite, called our parents that either they were to pick us up or to permit them
to treat it,
right. But I remember ice skating and sliding down hills on inner tubes, and the neighborhood dads, the streets were pretty much closed, some of them. So parents would come out in the afternoon and build a bonfire at the end of a hill. And again, it was just it was a wonderful childhood.
You said that you went to school. Was that kindergarten? So just 1 year of school there.
Correct.
And the area that you were living in, again, was that pretty much ethnically Finnish?
Yes, it was. The little college was the Finnish. Of course, it was English in instruction by then, but their heritage. And originally Finns had come there, Finns and Italians and some Irish, to mine the copper and iron. It's called the Iron Range, from there across northern Minnesota. And they did hard manual labor. one of my grandfathers came as a miner and in his 30s had a calling and went to seminary well into his 30s and then took up ministry. I lived there only 3 years and I was so young, but it's the geography of my heart. It's the place that I most feel at home and love to be. It's stunningly beautiful and empty, and Lake Superior is haunting.
Do you remember anything about the summers?
I do. They were very, typical Midwestern summers. We biked and neighborhood kids played together. We typically made a trip to my grandparents who lived in Massachusetts and Pennsylvania.
Did you have fireflies?
Oh, we did, yes. And lots of mosquitoes.
So. I miss fireflies in Oregon.
Yeah, that's right.
When you moved from the Upper Peninsula back to New York City, did you move back into that same neighborhood, the same house? Or?
Right. My dad just picked up his program. He's still pastored the bilingual congregation, was a full-time student, and taught at Wagner College. So very busy years.
You were there through seventh grade, and then what?
To seventh grade. Then we moved to northeastern Ohio, to a little industrial town, Warren, Ohio. A third of the town was black. Everybody did shift work. They did Packard Electric and other companies that largely supplied the auto industry, which wasn't that far away. It's a longer story, but again, it had to do with my dad. My dad chose the situation because he could have a congregation probably Thursday through Sunday or Friday through Sunday. Then he got on the train and he went to New York City to Madison Avenue to the church headquarters and worked for the National Church. And then came back and did that for 3 years. So very unusual that we had a dad who commuted to the city, to New York.
That's not a short commute.
No, I think he did it at night, though. And I think he worked a lot on the train and knew that he wouldn't be doing it, for the long.
What was his ultimate goal with going back to the church headquarters? Did he have something grander in mind?
No, it was to accomplish this merger of the Nordic Lutherans and to finalize that. And when that happened, he was an academic. We moved from there to Springfield, Ohio, and Wittenberg University. And then he really started the career that he had been planning for as a teacher and administrator.
Was your mother working outside the home during any of this time?
She was, and that's kind of an interesting story. It sounds like our family was all about my dad, but my mother was a very strong and competent woman. And when my dad was gone, she directed choirs and led Sunday school, and she taught. She couldn't teach full time, but she substituted. And she garnered quite a bit of criticism for that, both that she was a working mother with three children and that she was a pastor's wife working outside the home. But what probably no one knew and they never talked about was that my grandparents, being immigrants, had worked manual jobs. They'd never had any Social Security. They hadn't had any pensions. They had nothing much. And what my mother earned went to support my two grandparent families. So it was more than money in our bank account. It was real love.
From seventh grade on, were you in public schools after that?
I was. In Warren, Ohio, and then 3 years in Springfield, 3 years. I went to high school in Springfield.
And you had said, at least for these first few years, that there were many African Americans that were living in the area. So it sounds like you kind of grew up with all kinds of ethnicities.
I did, but yeah, a sad part of that story is that we were very segregated. A third of my junior high school was black, and aside from, playing sports with them in school and going to school with them, really had nothing to do with their lives. The neighborhoods were segregated, and it took me well into adulthood to realize what that meant, the significance of that. And it kind of shames me to think that we're like two different cultures side by side.
In looking back in hindsight, was there anything you could have done that would have been different?
I don't know. I'll have to think on that. Yeah. I'd like to think that there wasn't, but I don't know. I think maybe if I had been a little bit more insightful and not in junior high school. Anyway.
And those last 3 years of high school, they were in the university town?
Right.
And what was the makeup of your school there? Was it more quote unquote white?
It was somewhat mixed. Springfield was a university town, was in a small industry and close to some very prosperous, highly lucrative farming operations, farmland still owned by owned privately, not corporate farming, but there was a fair amount of wealth there. I didn't say, but we had an unusual situation. They had built a new building on campus with the provision that my dad was the dean at that time, the dean would live there. And so we lived in the middle of the campus. We were this so peculiar to have this family with three children living. So that really became my world. It was the library I used, and I could take classes and use the swimming pool and the tennis courts and
Was there some point in your growing up years when you felt more, quote unquote, American than Finnish? Or was there a smooth transition, or did you always feel like?
Yes, I think as soon as I went to school and started using English all the time, and my siblings were younger and never had the Finnish language experience, and we moved out of Finnish communities, and I've always been American.
After high school, was it understood by you and your parents that college was the next step?
Yes, but maybe the most significant thing that happened to me in my teenage years was John Kennedy announced the Peace Corps. I still remember that speech, and it was as though he spoke to me directly, and it became something of an obsession. It was just, it had to be on the agenda. So that was always in the background, but I went to college. I went to St. Olaf College in Northfield, Minnesota for a year. I was a biology major. My parents had moved on assignment again to California, where they were establishing a new Lutheran school. And it would have been a stretch for them financially to keep me at St. Olaf. So I followed them, and I had an agreement with them that as soon as I finished college, I could apply to the Peace Corps, and that was the plan. It got messy in between, but anyway, I had an opportunity to graduate a little early.
So where did you go after you left St. Olaf? To the school that your dad was helping to establish?
Cal Lutheran, Thousand Oaks, Southern California. And I applied and was planning to go this summer after graduation to Nigeria, but there was a civil war. I canceled the program. So I had a scholarship that they were holding for me. So I took that up and went to graduate school then next year at Northwestern in Evanston, Illinois. And I still had that Peace Corps passion, but now by now I was on a different course. And actually there were two Peace Corps programs, and both of them fell through for different reasons. One was Nigeria and one was Venezuela. And so I was doubly disappointed, but I went to school. I was majoring in English, and
what happened to the biology major?
I'd taken core classes when I was in high school. And when I transferred to California, I was called in for a credit check to plan my schedule. And the registrar, my advisor, somebody said, if you took so many more English classes, you could have an English major and you could finish up in 3 years. And so with the Peace Corps dangling out there, I said, oh, great, which was a mistake because really my heart was not in being an English major. And then once I was in graduate school, again, I compressed a program to get through.
And was that, again, a higher English degree?
Yeah, mm-hmm. That was at Northwestern. But I think all along having misgivings about it, but not having either the courage or the insight or the drive to know what to do about it. So I kept going. I wanted to go to the Peace Corps then, but I got a job offer from Valparaiso University, is in Northwestern Indiana. And my parents really pressed me to take a real job, and then I could go later, but to take a real job and start a career, which I did. But I was struggling wanting to do this.
Were you teaching at Valparaiso?
Yeah, I was teaching the English department. And that was kind of a life-changing thing. One of my colleagues, one of the folks in the department, was a Quaker boy, not a boy, but a young Quaker, who we became friendly, and he talked a lot about his status as a conscientious objector in his opposition to the Vietnam War. And it was those discussions that made me, for the first time in my life, really think about spiritual matters on my own as an adult, responsible for my soul. So I had signed a contract for the second year, and a Peace Corps invitation just showed up. So I canceled my contract. I asked them if it would be possible to take a leave and then come back, and they agreed. And so I did that. I went to Iran with the intention of coming back, though.
A two-year commitment to the Peace Corps in Iran.
Right. But this may be getting too detailed. I met my husband there. I met a man there, and we agreed to get married, but he got drafted. He was the first American Peace Corps volunteer to be drafted home because there were so many young men using the Peace Corps to dodge the draft. He had already spent 3.5 years there, so he was required to come home for a physical. And he said that when I got home 3 months later, it's quite likely he would be in Canada or in prison, and that if we were serious, I had to come with him. So I left 3 months short of my two-year commitment.
And this man was different from the young Quaker that you had met in college?
Yes. Yes. The Quaker fellow was just a wonderful friend and, in a way, a mentor, but very important in my life. Yeah.
So the man that you married, right, was he a conscientious objector? Or he was in the Peace Corps because he believed in the Peace Corps? Or what was his?
He was in the Peace Corps because he believed in the Peace Corps. But when his draft number came up, 23, and he knew that he would be conscripted, by then the war had gone on long enough.
In Vietnam?
In Vietnam. That he was strongly opposed to the war. I don't think he would have called himself a conscientious objector, but this specific war, he was determined he would not participate.
So you came back with him early.
I came back with him early. He was 4F. He failed his physical. So he went to law school, and I could not pick up my intended
job in
at Valpo.
And where was he from? Where were you kind of moved back to the U.S. to?
He was from Washington State, the only place he had ever lived. But he went to law school at Valpo because he could get late admission. This happened late in the summer, and he got, what do you call it, probationary admission. And I taught high school then for 3 years until he finished law school. Then he pursued a scholarship after that in Connecticut. And then when he finished, it was my turn to go back to school. And then I knew what I wanted to do. And I went back to study botany horticulture for the next 3 years. And then by agreement, we had thought about heading west.
And west ended up being where?
Well, there was a stop in Indiana. Each of us filled in for somebody's sabbatical year, and then to Portland. He came out to work Do you remember, whoops, the energy policy under Carter was up for complete examination, and the federally operated dams here through the Bonneville Power Projects was where law was being made. And so he was an attorney in administrative law, and this was his dream job, to be back in the Northwest working on exactly what he wanted to work on, energy law. So it was another really fortunate happenstance.
So what year did you actually come to Portland?
The end of 78.
So we're going to rapidly jump way ahead. You've been affiliated with Portland Mennonite for what, a year or so?
About 3 years.
Time flies. You grew up Lutheran, then maybe some other things in between, but what brought you to Portland Mennonite?
You're right. A lot of pieces came together. I was sort of struggling with my Lutheran identity off and on ever since I had had the association with Quakers, and it had been solidified. I was in the Middle East for a while in Palestine and had friends in CPT who were Mennonite.
Christian Peacemaker Teams.
Christian Peacemaker Team. And I was struggling with things like the liturgical nature of Lutheran worship and things like transfiguration and transubstantiation and infant baptism. I had never resolved them, and I'm, you know, in my 70s trying to figure these things out, but didn't have a place to go. And it was an accident. Our church, Central Lutheran, which is a wonderful community, was looking for a new minister of music. And I said, you know, I have worshiped at the Mennonite church, and they have a wonderful tradition of part singing. I remember their hymnal. I'm going to go and borrow their hymnals to add to the consideration in the committee. And I came and I borrowed from Kurt, lent me the 3 hymnals. But I stayed for worship, and Rod spoke to me exactly what I needed to hear about, this is what Scripture says. This is what it means for me today. It's not about atonement. It's about, how do I use my money? How do I treat my neighbor? But I thought it was a fluke. I brought the hymnals back. He did it again. Then I started coming once a month. Then I said, I'll come every other week. And then I started coming most of the time. I've retained my affiliation with the Social Justice Committee at Central Lutheran, but PMC is my church home. It's where I hear what I need to hear to get through the day and the week. And I am so grateful.
And have you found some kindred spirits here?
I have. I came without a spouse and without children and at a late time in my life. And people have been very gracious. And I think it's through projects like, you know, Night Strike and a welcoming little Southwest group and the Gaza Committee. And I'm finding my way.
Well, it's obvious that there are a whole lot more stories. I could just sit and listen to your stories for a long time, and we just barely touched on the fact that you were in Iran and then Palestine and so many other places. But thank you so much, Esther, for taking the time to give us at least this glimpse into your amazing life.
And thank you. And thank you for being one of the first people, I don't know if you remember, that we went out to lunch after worship early on in my meeting up with PMC, and I'm so grateful to everyone who's reached out to me. Thank you.
You're most welcome. And thank you for joining us for this episode, COVID Chronicles. If something you heard raised questions or you discovered a connection, take the opportunity to reach out and continue the conversation. I'm your host, Gloria Nussbaum. Until next time, stay well and keep the faith.